Hi, it's Tom here. Last Order is about to start in just one moment. We've got a fantastic episode for you today with the great Andrew Doyle, the writer, comedian, and the man behind Titania McGrath. But before we get going, I just want to tell you all about how best you can support Last Orders and Spiked. All of our podcasts and our articles are free, and we want to keep it that way. But to do that, we rely on the generosity of our readers and our listeners through donations. In particular, regular monthly donations help us enormously, allowing us to plan ahead for bigger and better things. Even £5 a month can be a huge help. So if you like our work and you want to support us, please do consider becoming a regular donor. Just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button in the top corner to sign up. One-off donations are, of course, also greatly appreciated. That's spiked-online.com and the big red donate button. Thanks so much. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the podcast that's for freedom and against killjoys. My name's Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden, along with an invited guest, discuss the latest news with a focus on illiberal liberals, censors, and nanny statists. In this episode, we're joined by Andrew Doyle, the writer, comedian, and the man behind Titania McGrath, to discuss whiteness, the war on wood burners, and whether it's time to rethink the BBC. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. My name's Tom Slater, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and I'm joined today, as I am every month, by the IEA's Director of Lifestyle Economics, Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom.
And today we're delighted to be joined by writer, comedian, Spiked columnist, and the man behind Titania McGrath, the satirical Twitter sensation, Andrew Doyle. Andrew, thanks for coming back on the show.
You're welcome.
So, Andrew, as we've got you on the show, we want to start off by talking about the kind of latest news in wokeness. So for anyone who may not know, Titania, your alter ego, is this kind of send-up of a posh social justice warrior, this woman who is incredibly well-off but seems to think she's oppressed, bangs on about white people despite being white herself. And I guess I just wanted to start off with a discussion about whiteness, which has become a big talking point in the past week.
Yes.
Particularly kicked off by this BBC documentary, which has been commissioned on the subject of whiteness, fronted by Afua Hirsch. There was a slightly strange advert that went out for it asking people, do you identify as being white? Do you feel you can talk about it? Why? Which looked a bit like almost like a white supremacist support group or something.
Oh, I thought it was actually a trap. I thought that was like a trap to kind of coax out white supremacists. That's what I thought it was.
To actually bring them out of the mix. Okay.
I assumed it was something like that. But then it transpires it was research for a BBC show, which, as you say, is fronted by Afua Hirsch, who's the Guardian columnist, who talks a lot about whiteness as a concept and mentions it, obviously, in her articles and her book, British. And what's very interesting about this, I sent out a tweet about this a few days ago when it was announced. And the point of the tweet was just simply saying that I think that this emphasis on racial difference and whiteness particularly is sowing racial division. And I was just making what I thought was a fair criticism. Maybe it's not entirely fair because I haven't seen the show. Maybe it is a really even-handed discussion of this subject, but I doubt it because I'm very familiar with Afua Hirsch's work. So I know where she's coming from on this stance. But nevertheless, the tweet went kind of viral. There were lots of people read it. So lots of people who don't follow me ended up commenting on it. And about 50-50 of those who responded in support of Afua Hirsch and the show Whiteness were either woke intersectionalists or far-right ethno-nationalists.
And interesting.
But it was honestly around 50-50, this kind of response. They're both on this issue in the same camp, in that they are completely obsessed with race and they want to see more further division, not unity. And that, to me, I think is what's upsetting about the whole idea. You know, the concept of whiteness, it sort of transcends, for people who don't understand, it's not really just about skin color. You know, there was an event in Edinburgh last year called Resisting Whiteness. And within that, they were talking about basically power structures, the idea of whiteness as a kind of this kind of nebulous power structure that controls everything. However, it is, of course, linked to skin color because the organizers said that in the Q&A for that session, anyone who had white skin would not be allowed to participate. So there is a kind of obvious racialized stroke racist aspect to the study of whiteness, which I think it needs to be interrogated at the very least. It's come from whiteness studies, you know, this thing which is a sort of the bastard offspring of postmodernism. And it comes from writers like Robin DiAngelo, who wrote a book called White Fragility. Mm. Robin DiAngelo believes that if you treat people the same, irrespective of their skin color, that is an act of racism. She thinks that you need to be hyper aware of race all the time. For me, all of this is illiberal. For me, I go back to the liberal values, which are, were encapsulated by Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. This idea of judging people on the content of the character, not the color of their skin. And you have lots of people saying, oh, well, you should read all of Martin Luther King's yeah. work. And well, maybe he was a rampant racist in other areas. Like, I doubt it very much. And I also don't really care about that, because I think the sentiment encapsulated in that highly eloquent speech is absolutely wonderful and is the ideal. And by colorblindness, we don't mean you don't recognize or see or even celebrate racial difference. What it means is you don't care. Mm. What it means is you just treat everyone as human beings and you judge them on their thoughts, their actions, their words, their deeds, not their melanin. I think this is what we have to strive for again and again. Go back to this idea. You know, when Christopher Hitchens wrote his autobiography, Hitch 22, he mentions in that when he was asked on forms to indicate his race, he would always put human, and he would refuse. In fact, and I think this was a governmental form that he was required to sign on numerous occasions. He refused to put, because as he pointed out, ever since the human genome was decoded back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, we know that there's no substantial difference between us as human beings. We are all the same, you know, so I find it really divisive, really dangerous. And what disturbs me most of all is this alliance, this weird alliance between the ethno-nationalists and the woke intersectionalists, which I'm not trying to make a moral equivalence there. I think a lot of the woke intersectionalists are well-intentioned people who genuinely think they're trying to make a difference. But what they are doing is unpicking the work of the civil rights movement, unpicking the sentiment at the heart of that Martin Luther King speech, which is why I do consider the woke movement to be essentially a reactionary movement, because it is undoing all of this great work and pulling us back into a darker time.
Chris, what did you make of this call out for this BBC documentary?
I was very struck by the wording of it. Mm. Do you identify as white? That seems right. to me like it could mean one of two things, possibly both. One could be that you can now just identify as being whatever race you want, which, if true, is just, you know, postmodern bollocks.
The kind of Rachel Dolezal right, approach yeah. to life.
Or it could mean that you think being white is absolutely central to your identity, which in Britain, which is an island in the North Atlantic, would be quite a weird thing to think. And if we're going to get people like that applying to be on the show, then you're going to get a bunch of outliers, to put it most generously. And maybe that's what they want. Maybe it really is a trap to pull in a bunch of weirdos who are obsessed with the color of their skin. So, I mean, he specifically said, do you identify as white? Do you feel you can't talk about it? Well, somebody like that wouldn't go on television, would they? Or would they? I mean, what kind of people are you going to draw in? Asking them, do you think that whiteness is absolutely central to your identity? You think it's very important that you're white and that you can't normally talk about this? Come on to TV.
Yeah.
Everywhere Hirsch, and tell everybody about it. This is not going to end well. For four-parter, I think.
Is it?
About,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I think or two-parter, maybe.
Is it two-parter?
From what I understand, it's going to be a kind of social experiment.
What is there to say about being white in Britain, right? 85% or so of the population is white. There is nothing to say about it. I could understand if you're a Bangladeshi or Iranian or something, then you've got a specific identity, whatever. But there is nothing to say about being white.
Well, this is kind of the thing, isn't it? Insofar as it was interesting, you were saying, Andrew, about how you were kind of having the same kind of flack, but in different terms, shall we say, from kind of, you know, white ethno-nationalists as well as mainstream identity politics people. Because again, if you obsess over whiteness all the time, that more mainstream identitarian way, the idea of, you know, reckoning with your privilege, all the rest of it, you do end up racializing on some extent. You do end up to some degree suggesting that racial difference is really important. And therefore it surely does give a bit of room for those kinds of people on the far right to operate, to appeal to that sense of identity.
It attracts them. Identity politics attracts those sorts of people. They love it. I mean, and we always use identity politics as though we're talking about the left, but of course it exists prominently on the right as well. Mm. And it takes this form. And I think what Chris is saying there is absolutely right, that, you know, the ethno-nationalists, they don't keep this hidden. It's not like they're unafraid to talk about their whiteness. They talk about it all the time in terms of genetic superiority and all the rest of it. So genetics, by the way, is something they know very little about. So, but they do talk about it and they do identify. And I think it's damaging, ultimately. I think all those forms of identity politics are damaging. And I will reserve judgment, though. But, you know, in a sense, I think maybe I shouldn't have tweeted about it so far as I haven't seen the show. And maybe I'll be proved wrong. I hope I'm proved wrong.
Maybe we should volunteer to go on.
Sorry?
Maybe we should all volunteer to go on.
No, I don't know.
What would you say about being white?
Would that imply that you did feel that you identified as a white person?
Like you say, I'm in a white majority country. I don't think about it. And I imagine if I were a racial minority, it would matter more to me. And I do understand that. And I do accept that. But whiteness, I mean, I don't even know why I would even think of those. But I don't think in any of these, I don't identify as gay either. I just happen to be gay. I don't identify as right-handed. I don't identify as 5'10". You know, all of this stuff. Like, I consider these aspects to be, of these sort of vital statistics, to be very mundane. And so for me, I'm not nationalist, so I don't identify with the country. And I know it's a personal thing, but I just don't think identity is for me.
Yeah.
I just don't see it that way.
It's interesting because, again, we should stress that it isn't just this particular documentary that's got this whole kind of whiteness conversation bubbling up. There's White Fragility, that book, you know, Dying of Whiteness, all of these different kind of books, which try to look for all kinds of social problems through that lens of being white and what that means and privilege and all the rest of it. I think it's kind of interesting as well how the kind of class dimension to a lot of this, insofar as the first point being that, as we said many times on Spike before, about how if you look at things purely through that lens, of course you erase class differences, like the idea that, you know, someone who's a plumber is on the exact same footing in life as Prince Harry is obviously a ridiculous way to think about things. But also how it does feel like when people talk about white people, like you see it in relation to the Brexit discussions often, they kind of mean those white people. It's kind of ill-educated, working class white people, the gammons. The classic example being Jon Snow on Channel 4 being at the pro-Brexit rally and saying, I've never seen so many white people in all my life, knowing for a fact that he's been to Glastonbury. It speaks a little bit to what that kind of means.
It's that happened again by the BBC kind of on Brexit night, when in Parliament Square, when the BBC report was asking people why they thought there were so many white people there, which is really weird because there were actually plenty of ethnic minority people there who were probably very confused. They were probably out of shot deliberately, let's say. And that was a very confusing thing to do. I mean, they don't ask those questions at Extinction Rebellion protests, do they, which are virtually all white. They don't ask those questions at Remain marches, actually, which are upper class white people predominantly. So, you know, it's a weird... a weird racialized obsession and whiteness in of itself. I mean, if Afi Wahersh in this program does interrogate the origins of this and why it's a bad thing, potentially, or at least invites that discussion, then I'll be all for it. But it does come from, as I say, this postmodern idea that there are these power structures in society, and whiteness is a form of power structure that can only be perceived by those who have either experienced this racialism or who have studied critical race theory. So that's why it isn't persuasive to anyone. And not only is it not persuasive, but rhetorically it's damaging. And I mean that in terms of the literal meaning of rhetoric, in terms of the art of persuasion. If you talk about white privilege, for the vast majority of people in this country who don't have privilege, certainly don't have economic privilege, they hear that and it comes across as a racist term because they don't study critical race theory. They don't, and, you know. So when we talk about white privilege, even that I think is a kind of unhelpful term which we should probably just dispense with.
And these are all American ideas, right? Yeah. A lot of this seems to be an attempt to bring over American race relations to Britain, which would not be a step forward.
I think the origins in French post-structuralism, so going back to the 60s, 70s, sort of migrated, but it's now being very much propagated by mostly American.
Yeah, I mean, they have very different, you know, different demographic makeup of America. Yeah. And you can, one of the big differences is that black people in America, for the most part, are descended from people who were forced there and were slaves, which is not true of people who've come from around the world, mostly the Commonwealth in the 20th century, to make a different life for themselves. So we're importing this very divisive, but also just historically very different set of ideas from America, where they've got much worse race relations than we have for all sorts of reasons. And it's just not a step forward. And none of this makes any sense in any country as far as I'm concerned, but it particularly doesn't make any sense in this.
I think you're right. It runs the risk of making us a more racist society.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's what we should be fighting against. And I know, like I say, I think it's well-intentioned, but that's what makes it even more awful in a way, you know?
But weren't you just saying before that the new idea now is if you treat people the same, that is racist.
That's literally what Robin DiAngelo claims.
Wow.
So,
who is a white woman? We should.
Oh, we should add that. Yeah, a white academic. So that, and you know, when you divorce the idea of whiteness from white skin color, you get into bizarre territory. Like there was an attack last year between some I think American Indian schoolboys attacked some African American schoolgirls. They were described as, because they weren't white perpetrators, they were described as enacting whiteness. through their violence. That's the way that I think a very prominent publication in America, something like the New York Times, described this as enacting. So whiteness becomes a kind of version of Augustinian original sin. It becomes like heteronormativity, something where we can say that someone is inherently sinful and wrong by virtue of something about themselves which they cannot choose. This stuff isn't helpful. It's obviously going to divide us all up, and it's obviously counterproductive. So
it's obviously racist, as far as I can
see. Sure, right.
And I'm not going to wade through all the literature on this to, you know, to right. make my mind on it any right. more than that. It sounds racist, so it probably is racist.
I think you're right, but I kind of strategically bulk a little bit, because I wonder whether, because the word racist is used so promiscuously by people where it's not applicable.
Yeah.
And then I start thinking, well, if I call someone a racist who is being racist towards white people or towards whoever, does that then add fuel to that fire? Is that not necessarily, I don't know.
And you do end up kind of being accused of drawing a kind of moral equivalent.
Right,
you know, in a way,
there we go.
A lot of the time this stuff is, the kind of identitarian nonsense, it's a kind of shtick, it's nasty and it's divisive, but it's also just oddly kind of performative a lot of the time. And I think that point you make about effectively colorblindness becoming a kind of dog whistle, as people would talk about
it. They say it is. They say that colorblindness is a racist principle. They say that Martin Luther King's principle is a racist principle. That's effectively one. I mean, that's quite an astonishing. And then they try and make these backtrack with these claims of, yeah, well, you know, if you understand his full corpus, then you would understand that he didn't quite mean what you said. No, he did mean what he said in that speech. It's absolutely clear, and you know, no amount of casuistry is gonna get away from that. So I think we just need to get back to elevating colorblindness as an ideal, and that does not mean pretending race doesn't exist. It means treating everyone equally. It's a beautiful idea.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's move on and turn towards some nanny state stories from the past month. So Chris, I know you've been keen to talk about wood burners and some of the claims coming out about also vaping in the US, but let's start with the wood burners first, because I know this has particularly wound you up. So the government has announced that it will ban the sale of coal and wet wood to be burned at home in open fires and wood burning stoves, etc. Claims that these things are the largest single contributor to airborne particulate matter, as maybe you'll explain to us what the hell that means, and that therefore homos will be told to burn dry wood or smokeless fuel, neither of which I necessarily knew were things. So Chris, why are you so incensed by this particular proposal, and what actually does it all mean?
I'm incensed because I have a coal fire most nights at this time of year. It's been a particularly depressing February. In fact, it's been about the wettest 6 months I can remember, combined with cold and howling gales. And the only thing that makes winter bearable is having a nice coal fire. And I know that people in London can't have it because of the 1956 Clean Air Act. Well, boohoo. That doesn't mean, you know.
You shouldn't live in a basin that collects pollution. That's it. You
know? As I've said many times, you shouldn't live in London if you want to have a good life. I don't live in London. So one of the benefits is I can have a coal fire, and smokeless fuel is not a patch on it. It takes forever to light. It only smoulders when it is lit. And once it's lit, it stays lit for about 20 hours. So most of the time it's burning, you're in bed. It's not the same at all. And this dry wood, wet wood thing, I mean, wet wood is a term that's been virtually invented for the purposes of this legislation, far as I can see. It was an extremely obscure term until a few days ago. Obviously, you don't want to burn literally wet wood or green wood. That's not what's being discussed here. They're banning the kind of bags of logs that you would get in a petrol station forecourt are going to be illegal. They are not wet in any meaningful sense. But to be sufficiently dry under this legislation, they're going to have to be kiln dried. And I don't know what fossil fuels power the blooming kilns. Or you can dry them out in a dry room, but apparently it takes a year for every inch of wood. So we're not just talking about, you know, drying the wood off for a couple of weeks after it's been cut. It would essentially criminalize logs as we know them, and it would criminalize coal. And for, I don't know, you know, to what end. I appreciate that you have smoke-free zones in Britain because of things like the London smog.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
We brought in that legislation in the 50s. Now we don't have any smog. So we don't need to carry on banning it anywhere else. There isn't a smog in Shoreham-by-Sea where I live, so we don't need to have a ban on it. It's just the government looking for something to wave around at this climate change conference in Glasgow, and I think there'll be more of this to come. And so although a lot of people listening to this won't have any sympathy for me, I know people have a coal fire are in a minority these days, But by the same token, I don't believe that anybody actually goes around complaining about, you know, a few people having coal fires or feel that they're in any way suffering in terms of their health. I don't think, I could be wrong, but I mean, so few people have these kind of fires these days, and most of them in the countryside, not causing any problem to anyone else. It just sucks a bit of joy out of life. And this is just the tip of the iceberg of what we're going to see over the course of the next 10 years, especially over 30 years, ultimately, for this net zero target. Yeah. And eventually, I think we'll see the gilet jaune out in Britain, because I say this is really a very small example of the kind of stuff that's packaged in here. And there is no one to vote for if you don't like it, because every single party is 100% signed up to this stuff.
So when does it come into force?
They want to ban it from next February, actually. It's quite a short space of time.
Do you think you'll resist it? You'll just carry on anyway, or do you think
how can you? What,
stockpile, you know.
Oh, right.
I'm going to stockpile to the best of my ability, but I haven't got a lot of space. My dad's going to get in 5 tons of coal. he lives in a farm, so he can stick it in an outhouse somewhere.
The trouble with these environmental measures is a lot of them will affect people's everyday lives. Well, I mean, I'm talking about coal here, because that doesn't affect everyone, but other measures that they're going to introduce will effectively, I think what you were saying about the gilets jaunes isn't maybe out of the realms of possibility.
No, it's going to be very unpopular.
And Chris, you've looked into some of the net zero stuff I know before. Like, what are the sort of things that you think will be coming down the pike in relation to all
that? Well,
they're
going to start with domestic transport. So there's going to be a ban on the sale of normal cars, petrol, diesel cars at some point. I wouldn't be surprised at some point after that they'll start banning the sale of secondhand cars. In a way, domestic transport is kind of low-hanging fruit. It's relatively simple, but only in theory, really. The actual costs, if you think about how many electric power points you need to power everybody's car, right? Again, less of a problem in London because people only use Ubers, but 91% or something of the population use a car as their primary mode of transport. Hardly anyone actually uses tube, train, or buses. Where do people park? Some people have got garages, most people haven't. Most people park on their street, not in the same place every night. You just park wherever you can squeeze in. So you need to have electric power point outside every home in Britain, essentially. The infrastructure, the cost of that is unbelievable. And that's before we move on to the domestic heating. So with 26 million gas boilers in this country, all of them are going to have to be ripped out and replaced with something else. Again, at huge expense. The more you look into the detail of this, the more insane it gets. And then there's stuff where we just simply haven't got a solution at all. There is no alternative to aeroplanes, for example. There's no solar-powered heavy goods vehicles, tractors, all sorts of things, boats, you know? So this is a target that, with existing technology at least, just simply cannot be met. Mm-hmm. And the bits that we can do are incredibly intrusive on people's lifestyles and unbelievably expensive.
And there's just a big part of that coming on the gilets jaunes point as well, about so many people feeling like they're just being pushed around by so much of this stuff, not just because all these measures will, you know, change their lifestyles, as you were saying, Andrew, but also people getting mixed messages. You know, the classic example being years ago, everyone being urged to buy diesel, and now that was seen to be obviously bad.
That's
for
where the real
pollution
is. It's from diesel vehicles. It's not the particulate matter you get from coal, which is slightly larger particles. It's the finer particles that come from diesel, which, as you rightly say, we were encouraged to get them because they produce less CO2 than petrol.
And then we saw a bit of a repeat of that recently with the suggestions that after spending a few years trying to encourage everyone to buy hybrid cars, now those are going to potentially go out as well.
They're going to ban them as well, but that's only because they've got a zero tolerance policy on anything. You know, we should really be moving to natural gas, which is, say, fracking. That obviously wouldn't get you to zero, but it would significantly reduce your carbon footprint and stop us being reliant on getting gas from other countries, which is all we're going to do in any case.
Well, let's turn quickly to another nanny state story that we wanted to talk about today. We talked a fair bit on this podcast about the US's quite mad war on vaping and e-cigarettes, this kind of wonder invention that has given so many people an alternative to smoking, and yet the US basically treating it as if it's as dangerous as smoking off the back of this big panic in recent years. So one of the main researchers behind the anti-vaping campaign is a professor called Stanton Glantz, if I'm saying that correctly. Yeah. He's under fire at the moment because one of his studies has had to be retracted. The study in question claimed vaping doubled the risk of heart attacks, which sounds pretty mad on the face of it. And now many of his other claims are being called into question. Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, there is an astonishing amount of junk science comes out about vaping, often by the same people who put out a lot of junk science about smoking. And there is no worse offender than Stanton Glantz of San Francisco, as these people so often are. And he has produced hundreds of studies over the years, most of which I would argue probably should have been retracted. This one actually has finally been retracted. It claimed, as you say, that people who vaped had double the risk of heart attack. This was based on him just digging a load of data out. Epidemiological studies like this frequently don't involve the researchers ever actually meeting the people they claim to be studying. They just get the data out about these people and look over a course of years whether they get heart attacks in this particular instance. And in this one, it was such a shoddy job that it was quite obvious to anybody who read it properly that there was no way of telling whether the people had heart attacks before or after they switched to vaping. Most of these people, the overwhelming majority, were ex-smokers or even current smokers. They were either switching to vaping or becoming dual users of e-cigarettes. And actually, as it turned out, a huge number of them actually had the heart attack before they began vaping. So it was a clown school junk science. And finally, actually, last week, the journal in question did retract it. So it was a small blow struck for good science, but a very, very long way to go. America's pretty much a lost cause now.
Can you explain this to me? Because what I don't understand about that is why this backlash occurs. Surely smoking, carcinogenic practice like smoking, which does, you know, demonstrably cause cancer, moving away from it to another, to water vapor, surely everyone would be celebrating and dancing in the streets and saying, this is, why are they trying to so much to undermine it?
It's a very good question. And obviously in this country, most of the public health people have been fairly pro vaping because for exactly that argument, they accept that it might not be 100% safe, but it's clearly a hell of a lot safer. I think you have to bear in mind that not everybody on the anti smoking gravy train is necessarily that bothered about people's health.
Right.
Some of them have other reasons for being involved. Some of them just hate big business, particularly, you know, big tobacco, and they see e-cigarettes as a way for big tobacco to carry on making money. Some of them just have a moralistic hatred of people enjoying themselves, of vice, you know, good old-fashioned puritanism. Some of them just decided very early on that they thought these things were probably a bad idea. And they had, you know, broadly plausible reasons for thinking that. Some people thought, well, this could, it could act as a gateway to smoking for young people, or it could be used by smokers to perpetuate their smoking when otherwise they would have quit. Over time, we've got, you know, a decade of evidence now. It's clear that neither of those hypotheses stand up. But sometimes when people make a stand very early on and become identified with a particular point of view, they're very reluctant to change their mind and do a reverse ferret. So I think there's a few reasons, none of which are, you know, justifiable in terms of public health.
And it was kind of wrapped up in this panic about people becoming very ill, in some cases dying after smoking like black market THC cartridges. That was kind of where it began, wasn't it, with the
US? That was a big panic last year, and that is now universally accepted as not being an e-cigarette issue. It was a black market THC issue with a particular contaminant. But although that was obvious quite early on, they managed to cover the truth up about that and then really mix it in with a broader panic about high school students in particular vaping. And as a result, they've managed to get all the vape cartridges in any flavor other than tobacco and menthol banned. And I believe there is now legislation pending, or at least up for a vote, which would ban all flavored e-cigarette fluids completely, which would be mental, really, but they could easily do it.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So finally, let's talk about the BBC. There's been a lot of talk recently of a new onslaught on the BBC by Boris Johnson's government. There's reports in the Sunday Times recently suggesting that it was intent on scrapping the licence fee and to move the BBC towards a subscription model. There was a senior source quoted suggesting that it was also eyeing a kind of massive pruning back of services. A lot of debate about this circling around, is the BBC fit for purpose? Issues around its impartiality, a lot of pretty over-the-top claims that we must defend the BBC or we'll be plunged into a kind of American-style situation with MSNBC on one side and Fox News on the other. So it's become a very kind of charged debate again. I mean, are these kind of just slightly over-the-top briefings that we hear from time to time from this government? Potentially, but nevertheless, it's definitely back on the table, talk or review about the licence fee, etc. So just to kick things off, Andrew, where do you think the BBC is at the moment? What do you think is going to
I mean, a lot of people I've spoken to seem to think that Boris Johnson is just sort of posturing, that this actually won't go through. But I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, I do have a feeling that the license fee is out of date. It's something that does feel antiquated. It does seem odd, since the BBC has such a clear partisan bias culturally, I would say, rather than politically. You know, I've always felt that it does a fairly, I know I'm probably disagreeing with people around this table, but I think probably does a fairly good job when it comes to the news reporting, with the exception, the obvious exception of Brexit, which was quite clearly, it didn't understand. I mean, you know, the day after the Leave vote, they interviewed a guy with a swastika to be a kind of representative of the Leave vote. I mean, this is just nonsense, right? And John Humphreys wrote about this when he left the BBC and talked about, you know, how they just, the executives there just had never met anyone who would have thought of voting Leave. So they were not in a strong position to cover that, and they failed spectacularly. So I don't think that can really be up for debate. But I think on the whole, they do try and be non-partisan in other areas of news reporting, and they get hit from both sides, don't they? I mean, like, Labour supporters have said that they were responsible for Jeremy Corbyn's failure. So, you know, either they're too left-wing, too right-wing. It's very difficult, and I have a bit of sympathy for them. But I think the licence fee, the institution is so infected with woke culture, it is not doing that thing that John Reith talked about, in, you know, to inform, educate and entertain. That was the original mission statement of the BBC. But now it doesn't really educate, it proselytizes. It sees people as needing to change their minds about woke culture. I mean, and this affects commissioning, it affects drama, it affects comedy. You know, that's why we don't have satire, really, because it's everything's just going along with establishment thought. So you don't have anything that's pushing against the grain. And the thing is, so many people hate that stuff. I'd go so far as to say the majority of people hate that stuff. And they probably resent having to pay a license fee for something that they'll never consume, because they despise all of that stuff so much. And they and particularly young people, they don't go to the BBC. They go to YouTube and Netflix or whatever. You know, they don't go there. And if the BBC is so wonderful, which I think it can make some brilliant programs, I also think it makes some terrible programs. And that's like any broadcaster. But if it is confident in its own quality, why wouldn't it want a subscription service? Why wouldn't it welcome that? Because surely it will make a killing, you know? So I do think it is probably time for, I mean, I say this as someone who works for the BBC from time to time. So I'm a bit wary.
You're biting the hand that feeds you.
Well, to be fair though, I had this debate on the Moral Maze a couple of weeks ago. So I was conscious of it then. But, you know, it's about the principle, isn't it? And I think the license fee has had its day, to be honest.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not a big BBC hater either. I think that partly that's because I don't watch a lot of its output. Every time I turn on the BBC News, I am reminded how ridiculous some of it is. But they do a lot of good stuff, particularly on the radio, actually, I have to say. Moral May has been a prime example.
Right?
Yeah. And More or Less and a few things like that. And even if you went to a subscription model for the TV, you would have to find an alternative solution for radio. So I think you can probably justify having a taxpayer fund the radio, possibly having some adverts on some of the stations, probably slimming down the number of stations it has. But I mean, they are genuine public goods in the true economic sense of the word, rather than the popular sense, which just means something I like. They are public goods in that they are non-rivalrous, non-excludable. You know, you get free riders if you don't find an alternative way of funding them. But the TV stuff, yeah, I think it's just a really very simple principle that if you don't want to watch something, you shouldn't have to pay for it. Right. And for most of its history, it has been a genuine public good. And when the TV license first came out, there was only one station on it, and that was a BBC. So by definition, if you had a TV, you were watching the BBC. So you just paid the license fee. And that more or less continued really up until the 1980s. The chances of people avoiding BBC stations until the advent of Freeview, frankly, was pretty slight. But today there are people who genuinely just never watched the BBC. There's people like me who watch very, very little of it. And I think I would probably pay my £12-13 a month if it came to it, but I'm not 100% sure. When I really think about it, there's not that much I watch, you know? Well, Line of Duty, but the last series, that was a bit iffy. Fleabag was good, but yeah, it was a few years ago already.
They do good stuff. I mean,
what's good on TV there?
I mean, I can't...
Doctor Who?
But even Doctor Who has plummeted. Suspect. Doctor Who's ratings absolutely plummeted in the last series because they went all woke.
Right, exactly.
Right, so yeah. they push the... They're constantly hectoring their audiences, saying, look, you know, you've got to be better at all of this stuff. And that, you know, didn't he go and meet Rosa Parks? And then there was,
I think it was kind of one episode after another seemed to deal with.
Yeah. Then a man gave birth in one of the, and wow, so on and so forth. So they're really, really, and then people just switch. I mean, but I think you're right, Chris, that at one point there was a validity to this when it was just a few terrestrial channels. And, you know, I'm always hearing this argument about those water cooler moments, you know, where everyone talks about the show they saw the night before. And I think that did used to happen. And I
think it still does with Netflix.
Right, there we go. Yeah, Game of Thrones or something, right? So that, I think, that's all gone now. And you know, we have to sort of move with the times a little bit.
There also seems to be a big, because there's a tendency to just see this in terms of how it fits into the marketplace at the moment and not being able to compete with Netflix. I mean, Netflix is a bit of a weird one anyway, because it's so much of its programming is funded on debt, basically. So the idea that it can't
But it's building up an archive. You know, the BBC's already got a massive archive. I agree with Andrew. There's no reason why it shouldn't flourish. Yeah. If it can get that archive put on to a workable system that is available around the world.
And that doesn't cut
off. There's
no
reason it shouldn't make more money than it does now.
What's this assumption as well about that if the news goes to a subscription style service or something, that it will become like Fox News or it will become MSNBC? Why would
it seems to ignore the fact as well that we have Ofcom and that these things are regulated in the first place for objectivity. And as you say, there's been far more levelled at the BBC in relation to impartiality issues. Now, you could say that's because, you know, people feel that they expect better from the BBC and they are paying for it and all the rest of it. But it does seem that seems to be a pretty mad kind of comparison. It just feels like as well that in relation to all this stuff, you feel that the BBC could make a case for itself in previous eras when it did have that kind of almost like high paternalism to it. It was this, you know, we are here to kind of, you know, educate and entertain and inform. We are here to play opera to make sure that anyone can access it. But at the moment when you kind of feel like it's not really meeting any of those requirements, you know, high culture is kind of ferreted away on Radio 3.
Barely there at all.
Even then. And at the same time, what it's offering is a mix of identity politics, dumbed down Saturday night television, and then just anti-Brexit news
reporting.
Right,
exactly.
There's not much that you can make an argument for.
Even if he was putting out loads of opera, I don't see why anyone should be forced to pay for it. I mean, Douglas Murray sort of made that point in The Spectator last week. He said they used to defend the license fee because of the proms. Well, sorry, but if you like the proms, pay for it yourself, you know? There is some.
I mean, that's a libertarian argument, isn't it? You know, you don't. If you're not paying for a service, why should you? Why should we be forced to? I mean,
but that's the same argument people make with nearly everything else in the world.
It's true.
What's so special about the BBC?
But it was an argument for it insofar as it wouldn't necessarily be easily accessible to everyone in terms of high culture. Therefore, you can, you know, make sure that it is available to those people, that, you know, those high-minded Reithian principles.
But all this stuff's available on YouTube, right?
Well, that's the different thing.
You can find literally anything on YouTube, high or low.
It's a very different situation now, that's fair to say. But I think the identity politics thing, Andrew, is interesting as well, because it has been going so far down that rabbit hole. I thought one of the interesting things John Humphrey said was about one of the things that really gave him pause for thought about where the BBC was headed was when they hired an LGBT editor or LGBT correspondent who made pretty clear that he saw his role as advocacy rather than just reporting on those kinds of issues.
Yes.
And, you know, as you see it in everything from that to Doctor Who, it does seem to run pretty deep there.
And allies are identified by wearing the rainbow lanyards or whatever it is that they're introducing, which they also do in schools now, you know. So a friend of mine who's a teacher has been told that he wears a LGBT rainbow lanyard so the kids know, then go to talk to him about gay issues, as though all the other teachers are clearly homophobic, you know. And this is the thing, this is the weird thing about the BBC embracing identity politics and pushing for sort of things like internships for non-whites only and stuff like this. They are sort of implying that they believe they're staffed by a whole bunch of racists and homophobes. Mm. And you'd be hard pushed to find a racist or homophobe in the walls of the BBC, I would suggest. So it's a weird thing. What they could do, if they're serious about quotas, is talk about their class issue, you know. Yeah. Hugely disproportionately represented are people from private schools within the BBC, certainly within the upper echelons of the BBC. And if they really care about this stuff, they would institute a quota so that, you know, only 7% of their workforce were from private schools, because only 7% of the country are from private schools. They'll never do that, will they? Because they're not interested in actual parity. And I think that's part of the problem, is the lack of diversity within the workforce. And I mean diversity of thought. I'm not talking about the other forms of diversity. The thing that matters most of all, that there's sort of a range of opinions, there's a range of discussions, but it is an echo chamber. It is a bubble. And I don't know how you solve these problems while it has that.
But it's just amazing that no one almost tries to deny that at this point.
They don't.
At all.
Well, why would they? You know, it would be utterly futile to deny it. No one tried to deny it when John Humphreys wrote about it in the aftermath, because they all know it's true.
And you get this kind of quite shallow argument, which is like, well, you know, we invite on politicians from both of the two main parties, never get balanced debate. But it's so clear that in terms of the preference they have for particular stories, the way in which certain things are framed, like all of this just washes through all of that, despite the fact that there's some, you know, window dressing of balance in relation to
exactly. But they think their role is about diversity and representation, right? And look, we can all agree, can't we, like back in the day when you'd have you know, soap operas set in London and everyone would be white, you'd be thinking, well, this is ridiculous, you know. So there is a case to be made for that, but they genuinely believe, because they bought into this postmodern thing of power structures, that's what they believe, that they need to push diversity and representation in order to combat systemic racism, which they believe is, because they're giving unconscious bias training to members of staff at the BBC, which has, as far as I can see, no utility whatsoever. There's no evidence that any of it works. Well, I mean, we've got infinite unconscious biases. You know, what matters is the way we act and the way we treat each other. But all of this stuff is bunkum, to be honest.
This is a modern form of paternalism, isn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, people tend to hark back to, a lot of people at least, hark back to the earlier days of the BBC and quite like that paternalism of Lord Reeve. Mm. This is just a modern form of paternalism, as far as I can see. And it might, you know, the direction that they assume the world is moving in might not be the same direction we necessarily think it is moving in or should be moving in, but it's just paternalism.
But I suppose the thing that is different and the thing that does distinguish it is the universalist aspect of the BBC being tightly shut out. So the idea that everyone can appreciate opera or whatever, whereas now it's like everyone has to have their little radio station. You've got BBC Asian Network, you've got this, you've got that, we've got an LGBT correspondent, we've got you all covered in that respect. That feels like a little bit of a change as far as it is that shift towards, you know, how do you have public sector broadcasting if you just think everyone's in their little boxes? You know, you are going to end up with something more like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris, Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew, you've got a lot going on at the minute. Titania's on tour. You're on tour with Douglas Murray. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about this?
So I'm doing this tour with Douglas Murray called Resisting Wokeness, and we're only doing 11 dates, but they're quite big rooms. So we want to open up the discussion about wokeness. We want to, because although Douglas and I disagree on an awful lot of issues politically, we both share this view that our new woke culture is making people very nervous about speaking openly and honestly about important matters, or even feeling compelled to say things that they know not to be true. Let's just take Dawn Butler appearing on Good Morning Britain the other day, telling us all that babies are not born with a biological sex, right? So there's that sort of thing, you know, and that does sort of show the way in which woke culture has definitely, it's not a fringe thing, is it? When someone from the shadow cabinet is making statements like that, you know, someone who aspires to be deputy leader of Labour. So these are all important issues and we want to discuss them. And so we're going to go around the country and end up in London. The final date is June 20th in London at the Hammersmith Apollo. So we would like to try and get as many people along as possible. So please do book tickets for that. It'd be fun. And the other tour I'm doing is Titania McGrath. And this is the show I did in Edinburgh with her. She's played by Alice Marshall, who's just such a hilarious and brilliant performer. So it's really worth seeing for her alone, really. And again, it's a short tour. Just wanted to do a short tour with her. And that is at various limited
dates.
You're
in it as well, eh?
Well, I will probably do the opening stand-up set.
Right.
Probably. That's what I'm thinking. 99% sure I'll do that because I just think it'll be quite fun. And yeah, I think it'll be good. And the other thing, I've just written a new book as Titania, but I don't know if it'll be ready for pre-order in a week or two. And that is a children's book. I don't know if you've seen, there's all these woke children's books coming out.
Well, like Feminist Baby and all that kind
Feminist
of stuff.
Feminist Baby. Yeah. A few of Hirsch wrote one, actually.
Oh, about Lady Hale.
About Lady Hale. Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
This came out months before the Supreme Court case as well, for some reason.
It's great. Like, there's all of this stuff. So Titania's written a woke children's book. Titania McGrath's written a woke children's book, and it's called My First Little Book of Intersectional Activism. And it's, I just got the proofs back today, so I'm going to do some final tweaks. But it is done. And, she basically goes through the role models of history, who she admires as being intersectional. You know, people like, Mahatma Gandhi, Brie Larson, people like that, you know, al-Baghdadi, you know, because a person of color who made it, Joseph Stalin, people like that. So all the people that she absolutely adores, which is modeled, of course, on that book, Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls, which is all these feminist icons aimed at little kids, but it's all these feminist icons completely airbrushes there. I mean, like, there's an entry on Coco Chanel, you know, one of the most empowering of all the Nazi collaborators. So, you know, anyway, so that's the point. Because I find those woke children's book hilarious. I just find it's such flagrant indoctrination. And you know the kids don't read it. You know, it just gets put on the coffee tables of these posh woke parents, you know. But anyway, so that's the idea. So that'll be out soon as well. So thanks for letting me plug it.
Not at all. Make sure you get that book. Make sure you get tickets to Andrew Dolan, Douglas Murray and Titania McGrath, which is also on tour. And see you next month. You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening and see you next time.